Good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and great to have as our guest this morning, Judge John V. Denson. John is a practicing defense attorney in Opelika, Alabama. More important for our talk today, he's a scholar, a historian, a wonderful writer. Be sure to take a look at his archive on lourockwell.com that we'll link to. He's the editor of The Cost of War book, an historically important work published by the Mises Institute. He's also the author of Century of War, another important work by John, author of many, many great articles. And of course, he's also the greatest LRC book reviewer. And one of our most popular shows is always when John comes on and talks about books he's read and why they're important for us to pay attention to them. Normally, he's got a stack of books he talks about, which is always quite wonderful. Today, he's just got one book, but it sounds fascinating. It's called Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics by Donald Jeffries. John, so great to have you here with us today.
Thank you very much, Lou. This is a surprise to you. I know that I've just got one book, but I've got a lot to say about it. The author is Donald Jeffries. He started off at 19 years old working with Mark Lane, researching the JFK.
Who just passed away, Mark Lane.
He did.
Yes.
Yeah. I just read that. 89 years old.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
The author is he's not a trained historian. He's got one other book.
Well, that's in his favor, isn't it?
he'd never get tenure now if he tried to be. But it's from the forward, it says this about the book. It says, "I can remember when believing in conspiracies wasn't cool. Now, in the second decade of the 21st century, more people are starting to sense that things may not be as they appear to be. The truth in Lord Acton's classic axiom that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely becomes more self-evident every day. Politicians from the only two parties we have to choose from break promises. They're unresponsive to the will of the people, and they opt for war. Austerity measures and state control over and over again." Gary Allen, author of the book None Dare Call It Conspiracy, defined things perfectly when he wrote, "It must be remembered that the first job of any conspiracy, whether it be in politics or crime or within the business office, is to convince everyone else that no conspiracy exists." So what I really like about the book is the format that it has. It combines a huge number of acts of government and cover-ups and murders all into one book. And it's much like the Declaration of Independence. I think he's using the Thomas Jefferson strategy here. Here's what Jefferson says in the Declaration of Independence that I think that confirms the format of the book of putting all these in one place. It says, "Prudence indeed will dictate," this is Thomas Jefferson in the preamble to the Declaration, "prudence indeed would dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and according to all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms in which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce the people under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now necessarily which we the constraints them is to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having the direct object of the establishment of an absolute tyranny over the states." And then he begins to list about, looks like 30 or 40 usurpations by the king. So this is, a thing about conspiracies. If you, people say, well, that's just a conspiracy theory, but conspiracies do exist. And a lot of this is about the conspiracy that is taking place in America by what I call the power elite or the dark state, deep state. Here's just a sample of some of the subjects that he covers. Of course, he covers the John F. Kennedy assassination, the assassination of Martin Luther King, assassination of Robert Kennedy, Watergate, the shooting of George Wallace, Ruby Ridge, Vince Foster case, Waco, death of Ron Brown, Oklahoma City bombing, TWA Flight 800, the death of John F. Kennedy Jr., which was sort of some of the, a lot of this is new to me, but I've read all these as you have, as they occur. But, you know, those kind of disappear into your subconscious for a while. When you put them all together, it's a tremendous message. But continuing, he covers 9/11, and that's the main thing I want to talk about because he brings up some new stuff that I've never heard of. The war against Al-Qaeda, the invasion of Iraq, the killing of Bin Laden, the death of William Colby, the former CIA, and then finally the Federal Reserve and fractional banking.
Wow.
Is part of the conspiracy.
Now, sounds like a Rothbardian.
Yeah. And he makes a reference to you in here one time. But anyway, the book came out in 2014, but I've just read it, and of course the title got me right away. But I recommend the book. It it has an obvious defect of no footnotes, but he writes it like he puts in parentheses where his sources are for all these things. And they're all things, they're official documents or they're newspaper articles and so forth. But what I would like to see is some book in the future that just takes the actions that you think the deep state power elite is involved with and show it. And a lot of these are, but he also has in here just petty crimes and the dysfunctional Reagan family and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That
well, John, this is an assignment for you.
No,
it's your next book.
You know, I would think that he probably did this all on his own. He probably doesn't have a staff that helps him,
no,
or an editor or anything. He just he wrote this thing, mm-hmm, and it's very, very, very good. And I think the people listening to this would enjoy reading the book because it refreshes your recollection about all these things that we've read about over the years. Because this goes back a good way. You know, when I talk to people about the book, they say, oh, it's just a conspiracy theory, as though that's an answer.
That's what we're taught to believe, of course.
That's right. And you just say, well, you dismiss it. But in my judicial roles, I dealt with conspiracies all the time. I was a United States magistrate judge, which is a federal judge. And mainly things that I dealt with then were the FBI. And they would come in for a search warrant, arrest warrant and things like that. And of course, I was the main guy about probable cause. I gave them pretty hard fits about doing that. And then the last capital murder case I tried as a circuit judge in state court was a conspiracy to commit robbery. And it turned into robbery and murder. And capital cases are cases where the only penalty is either life without parole or death.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a conspiracy, and part of the defense was, look, I didn't sign up for murder. I just signed up for robbery. So conspiracies exist. And I think when you put them together like Jefferson did in the Declaration of Independence, or he does in this book, then it becomes very obvious what the design is. And that is to concentrate power into a certain power elite and for things that they want. Now, the main reason I like the book, though, is about 9/11. And he has a witness that he has talked to, and he has the statement of this witness. His name is Scott Forbus. He now is working in the UK, but he was working for a financial institution on the 97th floor, mm-hmm, of the South Tower. And he says that they were put on notice in his financial office that there's going to be a cable update. We're going to put in new cables all the way through the South Tower. And he understood they were doing it in the North Tower, too. And so they went through these things of we're going to ask everybody to be evacuated on a certain time. And they cut off all the power and all the security for 36 hours. That meant... I've always wondered about this thing about the bombs being, mm-hmm, in there. You know, how would anybody have the ability to put bombs in those towers with all the security they've got? And here is the key, is that they were evacuated and all the security cameras cut off and all the electricity cut off so they could allegedly put in cables. And he says that while he was doing that, he heard all these kind of strange noises in the floor above him, and he knew it was a locked space and nobody in there, and mm-hmm. all kind of heavy machinery sounded like moving around. So anyway, he worked all weekend before 9/11, and so he was off on the day of the bombing. So he lived through it, but 98 of his people in his company died in. Mm. But he talked to those the families of those people, and they got calls on their cell phones to the parents and wives mm-hmm. and so forth, that there were all kind of explosions going off. That after the planes hit, you could hear these explosions constantly going off in the building. And then, of course, it collapsed, as we've all seen, straight down, like we put destroy buildings intentionally with bombs. So he now is living in the UK, and he has written to and called and tried to get 9/11 Commission to give testimony, and they won't do it. And this, to me, solves the question I've always had. Well, they had no access to put bombs in there. But here it is. And he says they're now denying that there ever was a power cutoff or that cables were put in. So they're trying to dismiss all that, even though he knows that that's mm-hmm. what he did. They were trying to save the information on their computers when the power went off so it would be there when they cut the power back on. So the whole building, in fact, was shut down so wow. people could put the bombs in there. But he's got a long statement from him, so this is not somebody that he doesn't know. He's got it in here, and all the facts about how they could have put bombs in there. And I think that's an important piece of testimony, and it's part of the cover-up is that they are now saying, no, we didn't cut the power off.
I've always thought it was interesting. It used to be a staple of local news whenever a local building was blown up and went down into its own footprint. Because it was so interesting to see.
Yeah.
That's never shown anymore. That's never shown. So
yeah.
I think it's politically incorrect to show it because, of course, it looks just like the towers. You're not supposed to remember that.
I mean, it's like telling you that 2 and 2 is 5. I mean, I know what I see. I count 2 and 2 is 4. And I see these buildings collapsing down.
And, of course, there's never been a fire that knocked down a building like that.
No.
In world history.
And of course, the statement that the experts say is that you have to have such terrific heat to melt, and that never would have gotten that hot. But they say that what happens, all this fuel dripped down and caused all this. But the fallacy there is, what about Building 7? It wasn't hit by any plane. It's right over the next to them. And it collapses just like the towers. So my theory on Building 7, and I think that's sort of a key to the whole 9/11,
mm-hmm.
is that I do not believe that the pilots of those planes flew the planes into the buildings. If they were held at gunpoint and told to fly into it, you know, they know they're going to be killed one way or the other, so why fly into it? Why not go into the ocean and mm-hmm. be shot in the head? And I do not believe that those guys that say were flying the planes, the hijackers, could fly a plane. I took flying lessons back in the 60s and learned how to fly a Cessna 182 is what they said they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I've flown into the Atlanta airport and taken off and gotten in line with all the jets. And they've quit letting the little planes come
yes.
in. It may be because I came in there. But anyway, I can swear to you that learning how to fly a 182 Cessna in no way qualifies you to fly a commercial jet. My brother was a P-51 pilot in World War II, and immediately after the war, he went with Pan American and stayed with them till his retirement. He flew every plane that they had. And he trained a lot of pilots. And one time we were both in Los Angeles, and one of his regular routes was Los Angeles to London and then to Seattle and back to London and so forth. So he was taking off the next morning in a 747. So he said, would you like to go up in the cockpit and take a look? And, the massive amount of instruments are there. And he talked about all the training they have to do and the training that he gave others to fly a plane like that. Any other commercial jet, it's just impossible for those guys to have learned enough that they could do that precision flying. So, here's my theory. I think that Building 7 contained the remote controls for those planes. I think that that's the way they took over control, and that's the reason that Building 7 had to be destroyed, too, because it had the evidence for the remote control. And that's just a theory. But it's based on the fallacious conclusion that those guys knew how to fly commercial jets, those hijackers. I mean, I just don't think they could. So he touches a lot on 9/11, and to me, 9/11 is the Pearl Harbor of our day. I think it was an inside job done by a cooperation, probably the CIA and the military, and it was to get us into the never-ending war of terrorism. We would never have the Patriot Act or the home security, letting the president kill people by meeting on Tuesday and making a list.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is a result of 9/11, and it panicked the people. Here we are attacked on our own soil, 3,000 people killed. I mean, we need to go to war. There's no end to the war on terror. And you would never have a Patriot Act passed during peacetime or a kill list for the president. Homeland Security. It's all a massive stealing of your security and of your freedom in order to have security. And so I think 9/11 is something we need to stay on top of and put the pressure on, like we did with the Kennedy assassination. People just kept demanding until they created people commissions to get the evidence. So I think it's an important issue to keep alive and put the pressure on the politicians.
You know, John, I wish he were still here and I could talk to him, but the late Kent Snyder, who was Ron Paul's 2008 campaign manager, had picked me up once to go to Ron's office at National Airport. We're driving past the Pentagon, and he said, my uncle is a senior pilot for British Airways, and he said, there's no way that any amateur pilot could have flown. They said it would have required, and he said it would be difficult for him to fly the plane the way it had to go up and down and up and down at the speed it went to hit the Pentagon. That it was just a fantasy, just science fiction. The idea that these guys who trained in a Cessna could have flown this plane that way, he said it, even the most experienced pilot would find it very, very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so impossible to me for them to believe that we believe it. I mean, sure, it's just...
Although more and more people don't believe it, right? And more people never believed it.
I think, though, that people see what they do not realize is blowback. They see terrorist attacks, they think. And so that must have been true, that 9/11 was a terrorist attack. And... just looking back, the skeptics just say to me, well, there would never be a plan by the American, the CIA or the military, anybody else, to kill American citizens.
Yeah.
And so you got the example of Pearl Harbor. And we now know that the plan was to let about 3,000 mm-hmm. sailors be killed, so we could get into the war with Japan. It was a planned thing, as we know now from the release of the military code being broken and the book by Stinnett, that it was just a planned deal. And there's an interesting one-on-one meeting with President Roosevelt that I have in Century of War as an appendix. And there was a congressional hearing back when Bill Clinton was president on the Pearl Harbor matter. And the families of Admiral Kimmel and General Short were trying to get their names cleared, and they were reduced in rank and dismissed by Roosevelt. So Congress passed a resolution recognizing that the people in Washington had sufficient notice of the attack, and if they had given adequate notice to the people in Pearl Harbor, it would have been prevented.
Mm-hmm.
So they made a finding, congressional finding, that there was no bad conduct on the part of Kimmel or Short, and restored their ranks and cleared them of any wrongdoing. But Bill Clinton refused to sign it. So, but while that was going on, Bill Clinton got a letter from a lady, and she said that her father was, and this was published in the Naval News, and I've got the whole thing in my book, Century of War as an Appendix. It says her father was head of the war division of the Red Cross for America. And he was called to the White House by President Roosevelt, and one-on-one, and he told him, he said, look, my intelligence people tell me there's going to be an attack on Pearl Harbor very soon. And I need for you to send supplies and personnel to the West Coast, and we will transport them to Pearl Harbor. And her father, who had lived to be 98, but told her about this in 1970, he said he's worried his whole life about the morality of that. And he told the president, he said, look, can't you do something to warn these people so they won't be killed? And Roosevelt told him, says, no, we could never get into the war unless Americans are killed on American soil. And
wow.
That letter, his letter is in there, and it's just a deliberate, premeditated murder. And yes, they can plan to kill Americans. There's also something that I was not aware of about killing Americans on American soil, and it's called Operation Northwoods.
Mm-hmm.
You can Google this now. This was a top secret document that was created by the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
There's actually a great Wikipedia article on Operation Northwoods.
Yeah, I've got that with me here, and you can look it up Wikipedia. I did that, and the story of Operation Northwoods is that while Eisenhower was president, he encouraged the Joint Chiefs of Staff to come up with some plan where they could invade Cuba. And Eisenhower left before they completed their plans. But when Kennedy came in, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and you can read all this, it was a top secret document, and it was released because of the Kennedy Assassination Records Review Board. It was released publicly in November of 1997, but you don't hear much about it.
No.
But here's the plan. They were going to disguise some jet planes as Cuban aircraft. They were going to have them attack in America and kill American citizens and military personnel. And that would be a reason to have an invasion of Cuba.
And knock down a civilian jetliner. Right, they were going to blow up an American civilian jetliner and kill everybody on board.
That's right. That's in the report, too. I mean, the whole thing is, they presented this to McNamara, and he turned it down. And so Kennedy ends up, he fires the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff named General Lemitzer.
Yes, Lyman Lemitzer.
And but he transferred him to NATO rather than make it look like it's some, promotion. He can go kill civilians in Europe now. But here's the military gets turned down on their main plan. And here's the CIA and the Bay of Pigs. I mean, those two things combined, that's when I think the plot came that Kennedy has got to go. He's too soft on communism. But this is a plan, unanimous approval by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to kill American citizens, civilians, and military on American soil in order to have an invasion to fight communism. So, yes, that could be a plan to kill American citizens in the towers.
But isn't this every single American war like this? It's always, oh, those horrible other guys attacked us first,
yeah,
and therefore we have to go to war.
That's right. As Roosevelt told the man that the Red Cross, that Congress would never declare war unless Americans were attacked on American soil. So... Bush didn't wait on that. He just attacked Iraq. It had nothing to do with it in order to get the war on terrorism started.
And, you mentioned about the that they needed an American Pearl Harbor. The PNAC report, Project for a New American Century of Bill Kristol and similar neocons, actually said what's necessary for the proper security policy and war policy is a new Pearl Harbor. And, of course, they got their new Pearl Harbor.
That's right. Yeah. It's exactly planned just like the other Pearl Harbor to make sure Americans are killed on American soil, and that'll bring the people around to go for war. And to me, this is the war they've all looked for, because it's what's going to be the end of the war on terrorism.
No.
Like Obama, I heard on the radio today, we're not at war with the Islamic State. These are individuals that are attacking us. I mean, Who's going to sign a peace treaty for the terrorists? How is this ever going to end? So I think that this book is sort of the format that needs to be followed and put all this together to show there is a design about all this in order to get to power. In one of the last chapters in the book, Where Do We Stand Now?, he editorializes, and he quotes longtime Senator William Fulbright, who was in charge of foreign relations in the U.S.
And pretty good on those. Yes.
And he quotes Fulbright as follows. The case for government by elites is irrefutable. Government by the people is possible, but highly improbable. People that deal in foreign policy know that there is an elite that they have to be consulted to in order to do things. David Rockefeller now, in his memoirs, has proudly admitted, yes, I've always worked for an international world government, and I hope to be successful. And he created the Trilateral Commission, and he's, you know, you've got the Bilderbergers, you've got all these organizations that's kind of the fronts. But Henry Kissinger's memoirs now says, what we've got to realize all over the world now is these nation states have got to start giving up some of their sovereignty in order to have an international control. So this is an old, old idea that we're seeing. We're getting closer and closer to that. And it needs to be an awakening on the part of the American people as to what's happening. The closest I think we've come to finding out sort of the inside scoop of what the power elite do was a historian called Carroll Quigley. And he taught at Harvard and Princeton and in Georgetown. Bill Clinton took courses under him at Georgetown and praised him as the best professor he had. But at one time, Carroll Quigley was allowed inside the inner sanctum of the power elite to look at their documents, and going all the way back before World War I. And he did a lot of research and had a manuscript that he completed in 1949. And he submitted that for publication, and 15 publishers turned it down. Too hot. So he died in 1971. And someone found that manuscript and had it published in 1981. And it's called The Anglo-American Establishment. I've got it here. A man named Zarlinger got the manuscript and had it published. It's The Anglo-American Establishment by Carroll Quigley. It lets you inside, and he says that that group has controlled the writing of history ever since before World War I in England and America, and that they've started wars. They started the Boer War. They were instrumental in World War I and the Versailles Treaty. So it's this man was inside the group and is able to write about it. So let me end by reminding us about George Orwell in 1984. He said the main premise for people to control the population is through war. And so what he has in 1984, he doesn't have one central government. He has three regional governments, like the Trilateral Commission. And it's just like in the movie Wag the Dog. Those governments are always at war with each other. They'll finish one war. You never get to see anything except on television that how the war is going. Yes, they're going to attack it, and you keep this hate going up, but the essential thing is having a constant war, and that's the way you control the people. And you have the, you know, the 5 minutes of hate and all the propaganda that
you've always been at war with Oceania.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, I think that's a pregnant warning by George Orwell that's very perceptive on his part as to where the power elite is and what their methods are. And it's books like Hidden History that can remind us about this long train of abuses that have taken away our freedom in order to give us alleged security. So I recommend the book.
John, it reminds me of what Murray Rothbard always felt, that the key issue for libertarians, or for that matter, for just for civilization, was war and foreign policy. And that's how you judge politicians, and it's how you judge what's going on in the world. Their most significant and, of course, evil weapon is war, and it's why it's so important to be questioning it, as you've done in your Cost of War book and your wonderful Century of War book. I want to highly recommend, by the way, this book, Century of War. It fits with modern tastes. It's not a very long book, but it sure is packed with facts, so beautifully written. And if you want to understand war, Murray Rothbard's book on war, little book on war, and John Denson's book on A Century of War, those are the places to go. And John, thanks a million for coming on today, telling us about hidden history. It sounds like a great book. And of course, we'll link to your books. We'll link to this book on the podcast page. And hope you come back again soon.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.